My name is Hugo Melgar Quiñones, and I am the director of the McGill Institute for Global Food Security. I welcome you all back to the 6th McGill Conference on Global Food Security. Bonjour, je suis Hugo Melgar Quiñones, director du McGill Institute pour la Sécurité Alimentaire Mondiale. Bienvenido a la CCM Conference McGill sur la Sécurité Alimentaire Mondiale. I hope most of you enjoyed the discussion, the presentation we had yesterday at our public lecture. We are all very much looking forward to a day where in this nice room, I heard outside is nicer, but this is a nice place to meet as well, isn't it? We have a nice day of presentations, of stimulating ideas, experiences, perhaps some confronting ideas and so on. I hope that you enjoy this conference as much as we certainly will, knowing already some of our speakers, knowing and having invited a wide range of colleagues to chair and co-chair the sessions this morning. So thank you so much for joining us today. I wish us all a very successful Global Food Security Conference this year. We are ready to start our sessions, and before I turn the microphone over to my very dear friend and colleague, Dr. Humberto Monardes, let me say a couple of words about him. Humberto is a professor in animal sciences in the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences at McGill University. He's also a visiting professor at both the Universidad Federal do Paraná and the Universidad Federal Rural de Pernambuco, both in Brazil. His expertise in animal recording has led to his international involvement with farmers' associations, governments, and universities in several countries in Latin America. Humberto is presently the director of a 3-year project funded by the International Development Research Center to assess the efficacy of practices and policies to improve food security in Guatemala. He is also the academic director of the new program at McGill, Global Food Security, that he started to lead this year. Dr. Monardes is a strong advocate of improving smallholder and rational livestock production to enhance food security and environmental sustainability. He will introduce our first speaker of today. Thank you so much, Humberto, for being here with us this morning.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. You perceive that we're going to take it lightly today. Merci beaucoup, muchas gracias, Dr. Hugo. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to introduce the first speaker, the keynote speaker of the morning, Mr. Venkatesh Manar. He's the president of the Micronutrient Initiative, an international, not-for-profit agency based in Ottawa that works to eliminate vitamin and mineral deficiencies, what we know as a hidden hunger, in developing countries. He's a leader in global health with more than 35 years' experience in pioneering effective international nutrition and development initiatives focused on the world's most vulnerable citizens. He's a chemical engineer by training, member of the Professional Engineers in Ontario, has been consulting for several international agencies, UNICEF, the World Food Programme, and the World Health Organization. Since he joined the Micronutrient Initiative in Ottawa, his work has grown to reach people in more than 70 countries. He has led partnerships with countless governments and NGOs and played a key role in enabling the consumption of essential micronutrient supplements, such as vitamin A, zinc, by millions of children in more than 75 countries. Using a multidisciplinary, multisectoral approach to promote the production and consumption of foods fortified with micronutrients, including iodized salt, directly assisting nearly 40 countries in designing, developing, and implementing universal salt iodization programs against iodine deficiency disorders, enabling the rapid expansion of fortification of wheat and corn flour in at least 20 countries, now reaching an estimated 500 million people. It's like the recognition that he received on December 30, 2012, quite merited, Venkatesh Manar was appointed an officer of the Order of Canada, one of the country's greatest civilian honors for his leadership in the global fight against malnutrition and micronutrient deficiency. So today he's come to give us the keynote, and he has entitled his talk as Improved Food Security with Nutrition, Collective Solutions and Limitless Benefits. Please help me in welcoming Venkatesh to this podium. Beautiful mouse. F7. Pardon me? But I'm forgiven because we are the first.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much, Humberto, for your kind words. And I think it's really an honor and a privilege to be invited to speak to this gathering of experts on food security. And I congratulate the McGill University and your department for organizing this event for the sixth year in succession, focusing on global food security. Let me start by saying that, that is going to be the focus of this conference. You're going to hear from a number of speakers and, around the world on strategies against food insecurity and hunger. And those challenges are well known, and I'm sure that itself is a major topic for discussion during today. But what I am going to focus on is the issue of nutrition, because it's becoming increasingly clear that the issue we face today is not just simple food security based on per capita calorie availability. Rather, it is a comprehensive food and nutrition security based on an affordable diet of high quality, a diet whose outcome is judged more by mental acuity and economic productivity rather than just simple physical survival. And I think this amounts to a dietary quality revolution as profound as the Green Revolution of the 1960s that led to an impressive growth in food production. So let me start with building my case of why I think nutrition is fundamental to the growth of healthy populations and what brings me to speak to you today about this. Undernutrition along with food insecurity and hunger are all contributors to the global crisis we are facing. And access to food is only a part of the problem. Food must be nutritious not just to fill people up, but fuel the body and provide it with the nutrients required to grow and thrive. Food must also be safe, and consumption for consumption and prepared with sanitation standards that prevent illnesses. And these challenges must be addressed holistically and not in silos if we wish to achieve impactful and sustainable outcomes. We are all familiar with the fact, and this number keeps hitting us all the time, that chronic hunger continues to affect nearly 1 billion people around the world today. What is less well known is the fact that hidden hunger or deficiencies in vitamins and minerals that the body needs but doesn't crave as it does in the case of overt hunger affects a much larger section of the population, nearly 2 billion people, having huge implications for human health, growth and development. If you look at some of the underlying causes of what causes hidden hunger, it's obviously the first obvious cause is the fact that we don't get enough vitamins and minerals through the food we eat. But another factor that is further aggravating this is the fact that diet, disease and infection could deplete the body of essential vitamins and minerals. And if you look at the underlying causes of how do we deal with this nexus of diet and disease, we obviously go back to the fact that the foods that we consume do not have adequate nutrients in them. And on the other end, we have problems of hygiene and sanitation that lead to disease and infection. And in the middle, you have a box about inadequate care and caregiving resources for mothers and children that leads and further compounds the problem. So I'm here to talk about five essential micronutrients. There are many more that the body needs, but my focus is on these five micronutrients, vitamin A, iodine, iron and folic acid, zinc. Our bodies, they're called micronutrients, as you all know, because our bodies need very small quantities of these nutrients, and yet, in their absence, the results are dire. Children in particular carry a brunt of the burden. And according to a recent series in The Lancet on maternal and child health, undernutrition, including a lack of micronutrients, accounts for nearly 45% of all deaths of children under the age of 5. The consequences of undernutrition in the first 1,000 days of a child's life, if you count the point from conception to the first 2 years of life, are severe, and they can constrain potential permanently, limiting a child's ability and capacity and even leading to death. But children that do survive as adults are physically and intellectually weakened. They are more susceptible to disease and chronic illness, and in many cases, incapable of enjoying a full and productive life. And while we can see the visible signs of undernutrition, including stunting or wasting or underweight, the hidden impact of micronutrient deficiencies is even more dramatic. Let me take iodine as an example. When the body becomes iodine deficient, it can result in goiter in adults and cretinism, deafness, speech defects, and brain damage in children. And iodine deficiencies are actually the leading causes of preventable mental impairment in the world. Today, in spite of significant progress in salt iodization, which I'll talk about a little later, one-third of the world still does not receive adequate iodine through the diet or through salt, and the impact is fairly significant. And to add to this, if we add the impact of deficiencies arising from insufficient vitamin A, iron, zinc, and folic acid, we have a significant problem. But beyond the health impacts, the ripple effect of undernutrition is long-reaching and lasts for generations. Undernutrition devastates families, communities, and countries. For individuals, it impacts growth and development, learning, IQ, educability, work productivity, and occupational choices. And for countries, a weakened population slows economic development and prevents nations from achieving their full capacity. In 2004, a group of eminent economists got together to try to develop a basis for allocation of the world's overseas development assistance. At that time, it was the order of $50 billion. Now it's about $75 billion. What is the best way to allocate those resources for maximum potential or impact in terms of human development? Even in that first list in 2004, of the 10 ranked interventions, 5 related to micronutrients. And most recently, they had one in 2008 and again in 2012. The latest ranking again places bundled micronutrient interventions at the top of the list. And in fact, they reckon that a dollar spent on micronutrient programming could result in a payback of $30 in terms of improved health and well-being of populations. Let me talk about the role of Canada, that has been a leading funder and supporter of nutrition worldwide. And this is not a very well-known fact, and you know, in our typical Canadian way, we don't publicize this fact, but an independent think tank, Development Initiatives, singled out Canada recently as the world's largest donor supporting basic nutrition. We average a little more than $100 million a year, much greater than all of the other major donors. Now, and this has been consistent over the past 20 years. There are several donors now coming on, both government assistance agencies as well as private foundations like the Gates Foundation or the Children's Investment Fund for Nutrition. But Canada has been a consistent donor and is at the top of the list. Let me talk a little bit about my own organization. Humberto mentioned a little bit about the MI. We have been in operation for nearly 20 years, and my work at the MI has enabled me and given me the opportunity to be involved in programs across the world to address the problem of hidden hunger. It's been a tremendous experience, and with support from the Government of Canada, we actually work with governments to develop, implement, and monitor innovative and cost-effective strategies. And some of our key initiatives include vitamin A, zinc, and iron supplements and salt iodization programs. And we supply about 70% of the world's needs for vitamin A to boost immune systems of some of the poorest children around the world, located in more than 70 countries. And over the years, MI has significantly expanded its portfolio, as you can see, from 2010, when we had a funding base of about $30 million. It's grown to almost $60 million. And the portfolio of interventions that we are involved in is also expanding. But a key factor is that increasingly, we're not doing these vertically. We're doing these as bundled interventions, and we're always looking for opportunities to integrate whatever we are doing here through either health systems or through food systems. And that is going to be the main strategy for the future. I just want to talk specifically about this man, Soleimane, a salt entrepreneur in Senegal. And he was struggling to make ends meet in Dakar about 10 years ago when salt iodization became law there. And at that time, a very small proportion of the nation's salt was iodized. And we went in and we worked with Suleiman as part of a micro-enterprise project. We provided him with business training and helped guide the loan process to fund his salt iodization and production business. And today, he has a thriving business that sells, produces and sells salt across West Africa. He employs over 60 people. And there are three particular facets of this experience that I'd like to highlight. First, we addressed a devastating health issue by empowering a community with knowledge and skills set to make it sustainable. And second, we created a solution that is contributing to build a stronger community through economic development. And third, we are empowering women, because most of the his employees are women, and they now have jobs. We are helping to improve the health, education, and overall quality of life for their families. But the job is not done. As you can imagine, the world has made significant progress over the past two decades. There are still huge pockets in the world where iron deficiency is widely prevalent. 41 million babies are still born unprotected from iodine sufficiency. And again, a million children a year die unnecessarily from diarrhea, and something that zinc, along with ORS, can save. and 250 million children are still vitamin A deficient. But obviously we don't want to address all of these through just one solution of supplementation or fortification. And that is where the link comes in with diet and food, and the need to combine supplementation with point-of-use fortification, with dietary diversity, and the growing potential of biofortification. And I hope we'll hear later from Eric Boy about the exciting work being done to improve and enhance the micronutrient content of various staple foods. They've had tremendous successes, starting with sweet potato and now expanding to cassava, beans, and pearl millet. So I would like to further build on that link that nutrition is crucial to both individual and national development. And the recent Lancet series on child and maternal nutrition specifically called for making agricultural systems more nutrition sensitive. And this includes the issue of both quantity and quality. Increasing the diversity of diets and balanced evaluation of the dietary intake of populations with regard to absorption, promoting, and inhibiting substances is another important consideration. Enhancing the absorption of nutrients in the food, for example, ascorbic acid with iron, and finally, addressing one of the core issues, the underlying malnutrition, hygiene and sanitation, about which I referred to a little earlier. So I would like to again summarize by saying that rates of undernutrition can be accelerated greatly with deliberate action. Leadership for nutrition at all levels is fundamentally important for creating and sustaining momentum and converting it into impact. Commitment to strengthening systemic and organizational capacities is crucial, and national and international momentum to address human nutrition-related food security and health needs has never been greater. And I think now is a crucial window of opportunity to scale up nutrition, integrate it stronger with agriculture and food. And we must seize this opportunity. Let us not wait for political will. Let us will our politicians to act. In closing, I'd like to say that this is an exciting time in our battle against the hidden hunger of undernutrition, and I think we are on the cusp of making lasting change. We are seeing growing political will at the global level, and through the Scaling Up Nutrition movement, we now have 43 sun countries signed on and committed to prioritizing action on undernutrition. The World Health Organization has set bold targets for reducing stunting by the year 2025 to 40%. But I hope we'll be even bolder and envision a world where no child is malnourished, stunted, or wasted, and where no woman enters into pregnancy anemic and depleted, and where no family or community is robbed of its economic potential due to the toll of undernutrition on productivity. Let us work together to this better world and break down any lingering barriers between food and nutrition security and march boldly in the direction of a world free of hunger and malnutrition. Thank you.
For such an emotional call at the very end of the presentation. Who is going to have the courage to start the questions? Because the floor is open now. One question on this side, please.
Is it on now?
Yeah.
You spoke about different solutions, and you've done a lot of work on the supplementation and fortification. You also talked about dietary diversity. Could you just expand a little bit on what you think are key strategies for improving dietary diversity and the link to agriculture in that regard?
Yes. That's the ultimate solution, Jim. I mean, we do resort to supplementation and fortification as immediate strategies to address urgent needs that cannot wait. And but the long-term solution is really to get our nutrition through the food we eat. And increasingly, diets are getting less and less diversified, and we know that that's a global problem. As people cut down on pulses in large parts of Asia, driven by economic considerations, and where people are cutting down on fruits and vegetables and animal and dairy products for economic reasons. So all of these are contributing to decreased diversity rather than increased diversity. And I guess it's a complicated task to try and again expand the diversity, given the myriad factors that affect this, including economic considerations, access to diversified diet and food. So I guess it's a huge task, but I think it has to be our long-term goal, and I hope that all of the other discussion will also build towards that same goal.
Hello. This kind of follows on from the gentleman's question in some ways. I think the idea of nutraceuticals has been around for quite a long time, a good decade or more. And I'm just wondering, because we need like public-private partnerships to actually help deliver this, I think the Food Agricultural Organization had a partnership with Kraft, I think it was, or it could have been Heinz a couple of years ago, to actually address micronutrients in developing countries. But the idea of nutrition security is that while we have malnutrition in developing countries, we also have poor nutrition in developed countries, so like a lot of diabetes, a lot of obesity, these types of issues, going to put a big kind of health strain on what's actually becoming very aging populations. So how do we actually try and get the incentives for the private sector to actually address both sides of the coin on nutrition security?
Yeah, a very good question. My talk was largely focused on undernutrition. Obviously, it's still affecting large parts of the world. But you're right that in several of the industrialized countries of the world, there's been a total shift from undernutrition to overnutrition, and where people are having a diet that is contributing to overweight and obesity. And obviously, all of this has long-term consequences in terms of chronic disease. And in all that we read, the food industry is playing a much bigger role in our diets, especially in the industrialized world, and growingly in the emerging economies. And the role of the private sector becomes absolutely critical, and obviously not just by themselves, but the private sector in partnership with governments, in partnership with civil society, to make sure that the food that people have access to is nutritious and healthy, and that's going to be the big challenge as the world increasingly gets drawn into fast foods and unhealthy foods. So that's going to be a big challenge, which is already emerging in some of the poorer countries. What we call the double burden of malnutrition, where undernutrition and overnutrition are beginning to appear in the same population.
Still this side.
Thank you very much. I heard you when you talked about the need not to work in silos, and I'm just thinking here that that problem actually, if you're looking at developing countries, begins at the government level. Where, for example, if you're talking about nutrition, you find it in one ministry. And if you talk about agriculture, it's in a totally different ministry. I don't know, are we doing something to ensure that policymakers try to come up with strategies that will bring this together so that we can be more effective in terms of addressing the nutrition issues that you highlighted?
This is an excellent question, and this is something that has seized policymakers at all levels for a number of decades, because nutrition doesn't fit neatly within one discipline. As you said, it is typically located in one ministry. It could be the health ministry. And as a result, the other ministries don't take any ownership. It could be agriculture or it could be education. They don't take ownership over anything to do with nutrition. And we're trying to correct that you heard about the scaling up nutrition movement. And that movement is actively working with governments and in countries to establish that kind of an intersectoral partnership to address nutrition. And that is absolutely critical. Agriculture and health and education and other sectors have to talk to each other and work with each other if we want to make rapid progress to address undernutrition. And that cannot happen just by each of them having independent programs. They have to come together with a common strategy and commonly defined outcome indicators. Even if it's an agricultural program, it should built in nutrition indicators. If it's a health program, it should, and they should be consistent and compatible with one another. And until we achieve that, and we achieve that level of accountability across sectors and across ministries, we're not going to see the progress we need. Thank you.
I'll take the last question.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for your presentation, Venkatesh. I think that we have made very important progress in the way we approach hidden hunger and food insecurity. The combination of complementary approaches and the way Macronutrient Initiative is presenting or addressing the issues is really, I think, looking back, perhaps 20 years back, we see a lot of progress. But one of the things that really attracted my attention was very surprising for me, given that this is an intervention that is very inexpensive, I would say, really, really, from a financial point of view, very easy to bring to place. Was the fact you mentioned, and perhaps I don't know if I understood correctly, but one-third of the world population don't have access to iodized salt. My question would be, what's the main burden? What's the main hurdle to reach that?
Right. It's really, yeah, it's a question of cup not being full, because in 1990, only 20% of the world had access to iodized salt. Now we moved to closer to 70%. Several agencies, including MI, are working on closing that gap. And, you know, it's the last mile problem where we've come to some of the most challenging parts of the world where, you know, iodizing salt and getting it into the market is still a challenge, because you're dealing with a number of very small salt producers, and organizing them, getting them to comply is still an issue. But I'm confident that over the next 5 years, we'll see that figure move closer to the 90% mark. It's probably not possible that we'll achieve 100%, but I'm confident that we can easily move to the 90% mark. Yeah, and yes, that's the other issue, that there are some countries in the industrialized world that do not have mandatory iodization, and they are seeing the consequences of that. We are seeing evidence of iodine deficiency appearing in some of the European countries, and I hope that at least now they take action and make it mandatory. That's part of the reason why we still have that gap. Some of the industrialized countries are not fully complying with that.
Ladies and gentlemen, the keynote speaker and the key questions are what they established the theme of the morning. So we have succeeded on that. Thank you very much.